I'm Angela Kelly Robeck, host of the Empowered Principal Podcast, a part of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
If our kids can't seamlessly just go into, you know, at a starting level into a company and be able to function, then we have failed.
Welcome to the Leader of Learning podcast. This is where educators can come to find inspiration to transform education through effective leadership. I'm your host, Dr. Dan Krynas, and my research and leadership experiences have led me to understand that someone like you, regardless of your role or your title, can truly make an impact in your organization. I chat with amazing guests who epitomize what it truly means to be a leader of learning. I'm so glad you've tuned in. Let's get started. Hey, Leader of Learning. Welcome to episode 121. I hope you're enjoying the summer or whatever time you have in between school years. Of course, last school year and much of the school year before it were very difficult. If you're like me, you're probably taking time this summer to think about how to take what we learned during the pandemic, during the emergency and distance learning and remote learning, and use it to our benefit to make education even better in the future. That's why I think next school year and for the next few years, we are in a very crucial and exciting time in education. And this episode really speaks to that idea. I was very excited to bring on a good friend and an expert in areas of STEM education and project-based learning, Leon Tynes. And Leon has some great advice for teachers and schools to use to help prepare our students for what they're going to need in the future. Those essential skills through authentic opportunities for producing and creating content and getting involved in STEM activities and project-based learning. And I can't wait for you to listen. So coming up after these messages is my interview with Leon Tynes. Leader of Learning, welcome back. I know we've slowed things down here in coming up with podcast episodes, but I'm happy to bring a few to you over the summer. And you know, I hope that you're doing well and that you are at least starting to think about, not too much, I hope, but starting to think about preparing for the upcoming school year. And that's why I'm excited to bring on my guest, an old friend. I miss you in the state of Connecticut, but I know you're doing big things out there in Arizona. I welcome on Leon Tynes. Leon, thank you for joining us here. I think this is a long time in the making, so I really appreciate you actually reaching out to me and saying, hey, I got some time, let's do this. But for the listeners, if you could introduce yourself, you know, who you are, where you are, and what you do.
My name is Leon Tynes. I'm here in Phoenix, Arizona, teaching computer science. I just left K-8 space, and I'm going back to high school with AP college credit computer science courses. Super excited for this upcoming year.
That's great. I'm excited about the upcoming year too. And I don't even have a new, well, I kind of do have a new job, I guess. But listen, let's back up a few years. You know, Leon and I, we met here in Connecticut at, I guess, a variety of different events and spaces. But yeah. I think what brought us together was probably really the passion for, in general, you know, moving education forward, but more specifically in terms of technology and the STEM space. As a matter of fact, I think if I'm not mistaken, I visited your school when I was helping to create a STEM class in my school, and it was a day yes. that you weren't there.
Of course.
Yeah, of course, of course. But anyway, let's start there. You know, I know that STEM and technology and engineering and so much about the STEM subjects are passions of yours, and you've really made a career out of it at this point, almost everywhere you've been. So I guess, where did that come from? What are some of your experiences there, and what really, like, what drives you in that area?
Well, you know, originally when I started, I was going in to be an English teacher because everyone said, you know how it is, Connecticut. Those are where the jobs are and everything. And, you know, double graduate of law school, you know, I know how to write. So, but I was asked to do this, particularly once I applied at a school, they were like, okay, well, but we need this other role. And can you do that? And that's, you know, when I was in my previous career in business and law, my focus was tech. So, dealing with tech and intellectual property, of course I knew, you know, Java and some of the other languages, Python just started at that point. And so they wanted me to come in and do this new curriculum. I think it's Skills 21 now. It used to be called Education Connection or something. And, you know, I dived right into it. They gave me a whole grade level and, you know, we came out with awards at the end of that year, you know, doing 3D modeling, video production, some coding. We were building even 3D games using Unity. We just jumped in at the whole curriculum and it just became a thing. I don't know, you know, after that first year, it just became, you know, this massive experiment that worked really well for students. And I had some great administrators at that time. And it was my second job coming in, you know, into education. And we really focused on making sure that we were targeting numeracy and literacy. So you didn't come through my tech class without writing and without reading, without, you know, you know, creating spreadsheets and things, doing some type of analysis mathematically. So, you know, I'm just grateful to be able to have that experience while I was, quote, young in education, to really bring things to these large scales and kind of small scale project-based learning platforms, because students were able to use everything that they've learned to do the project.
Now, what you said was that you targeted numeracy and literacy. You also mentioned the term project-based learning. So what I heard through all of that is that given your class, given your curriculum, you found ways to bring in the authentic learning, right? Like in the background, you had the goals and objectives and your students, of course, of we need to get these numeracy and literacy skills into them. Mm-hmm. But in the forefront, in the foreground, you were like, here's how we're going to do it a little differently, right? Not traditionally, but through project-based learning, through tech, through STEM, and this is how we're going to do it more authentically. And the reason why I love the timing of this interview so much too is that I'm hoping that you can talk to me and the listeners here at this point about how post-COVID, heading into next school year, we can do that. And I want to preface the question also by saying that, you know, I've talked here on the podcast before about teachers that I have already encountered in my career who are saying to me, I'm done with tech. We did so much tech over the last year and a half that I'm just done. I want to go back to pen and paper. I want to go back to, you know, old school traditional. And I'm like, wait a second, it's not time to move backwards either. We got to find a way to move forward that's not that sort of emergency remote learning and, you know, dare I say, digital learning that we feel like we've had to do now for the last year and a half. It's got to be digital learning, but like true 21st century. What does that mean to you? And how then do you think that schools and educators can help look forward rather than backward in those areas?
First of all, I'm going to gravitate to one thing that you said, like pen and paper, getting rid of tech doesn't replace anything regarding your process. So a lot of the times in my class, you know, I love whiteboard space. I love using them. I used to use the glass windows in my classroom as well. I love notes. I have notes everywhere. I've posted notes all over my house to remind me to do certain things. Most of it has to do with work. It doesn't really replace that, but what it does, it becomes a step in the cognitive process for students and for me, you know, because keeping, you know, having like a million projects going on at the same time, I have to have those spaces to be like, hey, here are checklists. These are things that need to get done. And of course, we begin to convert them into digital spaces using apps like Slack, using other, you know, a lot of the Google Suite sends reminders depending on what your school has. You know, we've used Microsoft tools. We've, you know, with what is it, Teams. And then we've used a lot of stuff with the Google Spaces as well. But that doesn't replace pen and paper. You still have to use that. It's still one of the best ways to brainstorm and to kind of come up with what, you know, what you need to do on a project of that magnitude. So number one, it doesn't replace that. Number two, we are preparing students for the mid 21st century at this point. We're not like, oh, we're 21st century. That's at the beginning. We are in it. This is 2021. So given the fact, and this is where a lot of teachers need to go back and look at what business looks like right now. What does it look like? Even if you step into your superintendent's office, what format are the meetings? We know that Zoom or, you know, Cisco or, you know, Google Meet, something like that. What are they using? What are they bringing to each meeting? Tech. Because this is the way that we collaborate in a fast and agile space where paper gets lost, you know, notes get lost. So our job as educators, and sometimes you have to take a macro lens to all of this and step back and say, what are we actually doing here? It's not about educating kids. It's about making sure kids are capable of coming into our society and our economy in a meaningful way. It's not about education. I don't know how many conversations I've had in the past week about this. If we don't prepare our kids to work, to be able to ideate, to be able to become entrepreneurs, to be able to start businesses and things like that, we have failed. So it doesn't matter. The test scores, yeah, they're great. And they're a good litmus test for some of the things that we need to do in our classes. But they are definitely not the end all. If our kids can't seamlessly just go into, you know, at a starting level into a company and be able to function, then we have failed. So that's why a lot of these, you know, when we're talking about project-based learning, we're talking about using tech. We're using tech because the industry uses tech. So, I mean, that needs to be clear. We're not here to teach on our terms. We're supposed to say, hey, 2049, what does that look like? And when we don't kind of whittle our vision to where it needs to go and where these kids are going to end up, then we have failed as educators. But that's the first thing. You need to know where you're going. And obviously, a lot of people are like, oh, I just want to teach the math competency. Really? Is that it? Are you sure that's it? You know, oh, I just want to, you know, pass, you know, whatever exam the state exams are, or, you know, the quarterly thing that came down from my district. You know, knowing math discreetly means absolutely nothing. Zero. Knowing ELA discreetly means absolutely nothing. Because if they can't integrate it into something that actually means something that's going to go out to the public or that's going to be seen by a whole bunch of different people, then we haven't prepared them.
You know, I agree with so much of what you said. And one of the things that I've been thinking about regarding what I said before about teachers who are like, I just want to go back to pen and paper. You know, like you said, that's okay. You know, some traditional instruction is okay. I was an English, you know, classroom English teacher, and I told these teachers who were kind of pushing back on the tech, I said, I got my kids writing essays on pen and paper. Mm-hmm. I understood the importance of getting them to sit there with a physical book in front of them when they were mm-hmm. reading. Mm-hmm. I wasn't forcing them to type essays. I wasn't forcing them to read ebooks. So I understand right. that there is a place for traditional type of mm-hmm. instruction and traditional activity, learning activities. And that's why I've been really harping on blended learning, you know, the term blended learning and sort of, I guess, reintroducing the concept now, like you said, 21 years into the 21st century. And I think that's important. And I heard a lot of that in your answer right there. I want to push you a little bit, and no offense to you, you know this, we've known each other for a while, but I've had a lot of guests on here make pretty general, pretty blanket statements, some like the ones that you mentioned where it's like, hey, we got to prepare kids for the jobs of tomorrow, give them the skills that they're going to need for jobs of tomorrow. But how do we do that, right? Some of my ideas in the past that I think have worked pretty well are taking the idea like Genius Hour and providing opportunities for students to leverage their interests and abilities on very unique and individualized levels, and have teachers hopefully bring in their content knowledge and expertise to guide students through those types of projects. Are there ideas that you have or things that you've done in your experience that have worked really well when it comes to, you know, providing students with those skills for the future, you know, college and career readiness, all that?
See, I'm one of those teachers. I go get what I want. I don't wait. I don't wait for the structure to be there. I know that I'm doing something that a lot of schools are just like, well, I don't know what that is. I don't know how you're doing what you do. Okay, great. But getting kids to be imaginative and actually curative in their thinking, meaning like, wow, you know, Mr. Tynes, there's this stop sign over here that everyone runs. What's a way that we can innovate that stop sign in a way to be able to make sure that people are stopping because there's kids crossing and things like that? You know, I've done those types of activities in class where, you know, a lot of it is research, a lot of it is writing, a lot of it is, hey, let's do an executive summary of what you want your project to be. And I get other teachers involved, you know, from, you know, ELA, math, science, engineering. And, you know, we create kind of like this panel thing and we say, hey, here are these domains. You know, I make this massive, you know, rubric. And we go through and we go back and forth with them with revisions. You know, it's part of the design thinking process. And then sometimes we say, okay, now let's do a small prototype and then we'll go to the big prototype. So like challenges like Samsung Solve for Tomorrow, there's a whole bunch of other challenges out there to get kids to really think locally first instead of like, oh, I want to, you know, develop a new process for nuclear fusion or something. Like, we don't have to think that big. But if it's something like a stop sign, something like, you know, a procedure at school that could be, you know, infused with tech or make it a little bit faster with tech, you know, whether, you know, kids in a lunchroom, they scan a badge or something like that, you know, just one of those simple processes that may, you know, have an impact on your community or for, you know, your school. But making that like a small business incubator and make it feel like that for those kids that don't like reading, kids that don't like writing, kids that hate math, all of a sudden have to use those tools in order to get the project done. And so that's the point. It also creates like a ton of agency within students, and they get validation across the way if, you know, the whole time, if you structure it correct. So, you know, when you're involving all the other teachers, and I need help too. So I'm like, hey, science teacher, these kids want to do this. I've researched this. I think it's viable. What do you think? Getting an extra pair of eyes. So it's not like Mr. Tynes on an island or, you know, a tech teacher on an island or, you know, a specific teacher on an island. This is the way to make a team and say, hey, let's do this PBL piece, you know, involve a lot of tech in it. And then I can teach Excel. I can teach, you know, Google Sheets. I can teach Word. I can teach PowerPoint or slides. You think about what one of these projects does for the entire grade level. It's insane. So, you know, but we have to get there. You know what I mean? So that's what I think 21st century or, you know, 22nd century education looks like. It's we want to make sure these kids can solve problems and really think and really be able to work in a group and see value in each other and see value in your teachers.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, obviously, you and I are very like-minded when it comes to that idea of like, that's where we need to go with education. I also know my listeners very well, those leaders of learning out there. They're the ones who are trying to push this idea as well. The idea that right. We need to innovate our instruction and we need to get our students ready for give them the skills and get them ready for the jobs of tomorrow. But as you know, we still work with educators who don't understand, yep. Right? Yep. They want to still stick with the traditional. They don't get the more, I'm going to use the word abstract. I don't think it's an abstract. I don't think it should be an abstract concept anymore, but I think to right. some educators, it's still an abstract concept. The one like you were just sharing where we want our kids working on projects and authentic learning first and foremost, and use those opportunities to bring in the interdisciplinary studies and the content expertise along with it. I know that people listening aren't those teachers, but they work with those teachers. How can we, what can we say to them? How can we work with them to help move them along as well?
Well, we can't disenfranchise those teachers. We can't. They're a wealth of knowledge, and you know, usually they're older, or they've been teaching for, you know, way beyond 15 years. That's the thing. We can't disenfranchise them, but we can't flood them either. So, and I, you know, as a coach that, if you give someone too many things to work on, that was something that I dealt with the past year. You know, they wanted to do, have a switch to Danielson, but they wanted everyone to work on every domain of Danielson. And I'm like, nope, that's never going to happen. You need to pick two or three things for teachers to be able to digest. And we need to do the same thing when we're talking about PBL or any innovative structure like this. So what I'm saying is they don't necessarily have to take a lead role on this, right? You know, right away. I think people get it once you go through a cycle. So once you've gone through, say, oh, we're going to spend like, you know, 45 to 60 days on this project. Now, this doesn't mean that you do it every single day. You find a lead teacher that wants to do it, and you carve out the times and the spaces in the classes. So it doesn't, you know, interfere with the traditional instruction. However, if you have your more active teachers, your teachers that really understand what PBL looks like and are kind of eager and everything, let them lead the ship. And then, so like, if I say I'm doing like seventh grade level or something like that. So, and then I have some social studies teachers that are like, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. You let them handle some smaller details, you know, within their domains, within social studies, say, hey, I want you to guide what this looks like, what this looked like in the Industrial Revolution. And I want you to make sure that they can make a comparison in their executive summary to now. And it could just be a really nicely crafted paragraph that they're responsible for within that executive summary, which is like 2 to 3 pages. Giving them something like that, that they can understand. And once they see a cycle and they reflect on what the student done and how they've integrated their subject into that project, the bell rings. So the same way we do things with kids, and we need to be patient with kids, we need to do the same thing with adults as well. And just introduce them into the cycle. And you know what? I've seen a lot of things click, and then even, you know, the ones that are still kind of resistant, they lose their resistance, you know, but are they going to be 100% PBL? Absolutely not. But just build capacity, just say, this is what's going to happen, and just give them a smaller role at it. And you'll see that capacity grow and grow and grow once they become more involved.
No, that's great advice. You know, I agree that you need to leverage the early adopters and the you know, the people who are more eager and willing to kind of jump in, and they're not as afraid maybe to take risks. Most often, like you said, they're the younger teachers, while bringing in the veterans, the more resistant teachers, you know, kind of taking baby steps with them, making them feel comfortable. One of the things I always say, and, you know, this came up in my research and in my dissertation, I've mentioned it on the podcast before, helping people feel comfortable by addressing their discomfort, really getting to know why they don't feel comfortable about something. You know, the teachers I mentioned to you a few minutes ago who were trying to really push back on me and the idea of technology. And I said to them, like, I'm not the technology police, you know, I'm not telling you how much technology to use. I just want to help you, you know, blend that learning and blend the traditional and the non-traditional instruction. But where was I going with this? I think that upon sort of reflecting on the why behind their resistance, I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that they themselves don't feel very comfortable with technology, or
absolutely not.
They feel a lot less comfortable than their students. I have a feeling those teachers who during COVID realized how much more prepared their students were than they were for the Zoom calls and the Google Meets and everything that we had to do with technology. They're the ones who are like, oh, wait a second. I can't do as much technology. And again, I don't think we need to do that much. You know, depending on how school looks next school year, we shouldn't have as much hybrid instruction going on, you know, where you have students in person and at home.
Right.
So it really should be time to focus now back to the blended learning.
But why not? So COVID just exposed a lot of crazy, a lot of deficiencies that we have, and a lot of assumptions even that I had about connectivity with our kids and our families. We're not where we should be as a society regarding meaningful connectivity. I don't mean the just, you know, Wi-Fi and dealing with TikTok and stuff like that.
I just want to mention that, you know, I think that I work for a really great district who is pretty visionary when it comes to where we need to be. And I do want to mention, because, you know, you asked why not, like, one of the things that we are starting but sort of keeping in place that came out of COVID was starting a virtual academy in our district. Right now it's going to be more geared toward the 11th and 12th graders who need a little bit extra support to get them where they need to be in terms of college and career readiness. But that is definitely something that my colleagues in the digital learning department and in my district in general, we want to make sure that the students who thrived in that setting with digital learning and remote learning, maybe students who have jobs, who have responsibilities that take them away from being an in-person or a successful in-person student, that's an opportunity we want to continue. So, I agree.
I just think we need to move beyond synchronous education 100%, meaning, and it can work within this paradigm of, you know, you come to school every day. It does work within that. But you and I both know attendance problems, family member gets sick because COVID is not going away yet. So it's not like we can eradicate it. We can't do that yet. So we're still going to have these problems where kids are going to miss. We're still going to have those in life, period. We're going to have, you know, all types of, you know, socioeconomic problems, you know, family dynamic problems where the kid's just out or, you know, randomly breaks their leg or something like that. That's, you know, that's so how do we create a no days off kind of school environment? And the way that we do that, and this is what I'm saying, where teachers need to kind of be their own visionaries as well. And most of us use LMSs. Why aren't we creating these little nuggets of or repositories of information for kids? So I ran into a friend, and I can't remember her name right now, but we presented at Indiana University, right before COVID started. Wow. Yeah, it was at like January, early February before COVID. Before COVID was announced, excuse me, not started, but announced. And she was showing this whole thing using, I forgot which program she was using, but it was basically a repository for all the little math things that like issues. So if it was distributive property, if it was this, she had like 10 videos of it, and it's videos that she'd done in the last 5 years. So it was like, so if a kid was missing something, or she started to chronicle her, like her lesson introductions, things like that. And, you know, a little bit of the worksheet and stuff like that. This is something that teachers can do to kind of get ahead. And it's like, oh, this kid is having this problem. So I know we used, Class Dojo at the K-8 that I just left, and a lot of people are using Remind and things like that. So you can actually tailor what you're doing in your classes to your student. So if you know you have a student, wow, the student tanked this assessment, and I've identified the problem, I'm talking to the students, instead of mom like freaking out, oh no, my child's going to get an F, I'm sending mom targeted information that pertains to what the problem is for that student. That's the way we need to start looking at integrating technology. Papers get lost, especially K-8. Oh gosh, forget it. High school too. Put it, yeah, give a teenager a piece of paper, it's not going to make it home. So if we know this, and we know that these are benefits of digital communication and organization and meeting them where they communicate. They use TikTok. They use YouTube. I went on a YouTube rant few days ago where I was just like in this loop. Then I started watching Netflix and I went right back to that loop again. So it's the way that we intake, you know, if I need to find something for my car, we don't go, oh, I need to go to a store and let me go get a buy a manual and then look up that part or whatever for my car, when it takes seconds to be able to do it online, to order it and everything. You can maybe be able to pick it up same day or have it, you know, rush delivered through Amazon. This is the world that we live in. So it's not just about technology. It's about using it as a tool to make your practice more efficient and fulfilling, meaning that, yes, we can help students with special needs. We can help students with problems. We can do all of these things and get the content not just only to the student, but to the parent. So that the parent understands where their child is having a problem and we're giving them the information. Hey, have your child practice this, you know, 3 times a week, you know, blah, 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 blah. Here's, you know, a program that they can use. We're not using that to our advantage as educators. And that's what we are talking about. You and I were talking about technology from that perspective, not just computer science, but just all the apps, all the programs, all the assistive things that we have now, we need to be maximizing it. So when a teacher says, we don't need tech, yikes. How are we meeting the students where they are and where they communicate?
I really love those ideas. You know, and the one that you just mentioned a minute ago that I think is, you know, we've talked about it for a long time, but it really is becoming more prevalent, more important because of the way that education has looked and the way that we've, I think, started to understand like the importance of parents and families and really like, really, truly bringing them into the fold as stakeholders in their kids' education. I would actually love to talk more about that maybe on another episode. But before we wrap up on this episode, I got to be honest, buddy. Sometimes it's hard keeping track of what all the side projects that you have going on. I know that in terms of your day to day job, you're switching to a new school. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
You sent me this website, pbs.org, and I want to make sure I get this right, the Nova Science Studio. So maybe you can explain that. I know Nat Geo has always been really important to you. Talk about some of those projects a little bit before we go.
Well, first of all, I'm hungry for knowledge. Like, that just never stops. Anything I can do to help my students or bring it to the classroom, I do. And that's just me. That's a mindset. Will it happen with every teacher? Not necessarily. You know that. But that's just me. That's just me coming from the industry, from a different industry into this industry. So I'm just, I want more. So that particular project, Nova Science Studio, we took a group of eighth graders and, you know, I was dealing with, a population, 92% ELL, 98%, free and reduced lunch, almost all Hispanic and Native. A few African-American students, but taking that population that had never created content in an academic way ever and making them wrap up a research project of their choice based on science, you know, social science, citizen science, whatever they wanted to do, and to make a 5 to 7 minute documentary that will live on PBS forever. And I'm in the process of editing those now, but to be able to do that, to be able to get them to, you know, create narratives, to create scripts, storyboards, to see the struggle at the beginning and to see how it ended up at the end using technology, of course, but infusing, you know, I partnered with my science teacher. She was absolutely amazing. And some ELA teachers to make sure that we had everything correct. There was some PBS staff that came actually into the classroom at the end of the year when, you know, we had our protocols together. We were in person, but we did a lot of Zooms with the PBS staff. But it's just converting students from consuming media into creating media is such a task. And for them to be empowered to be in front of the camera, for them to be empowered to be in front of the tech and say, wow, I decide the way this story plays out. I decide, you know, how we're going to introduce everything, you know, making those decisions. It's just a big thing. And to wrap that up in there, not only just their tech class, but their science class at the same time and hit all of the academic standards in both classes, including ELA, in that one project. So that's why I do this work. That's why I seek out those things and, you know, making sure that, you know, we wrap the standards up in them. We articulate the standards for our administration. Guys, I can't explain that any more in detail. Your lesson plans have to be on point. Your use of the standards have to be on point. You do it a couple of times and, you know, as a coach, admin's going to leave you alone. They're going to be like, wow, you've, you know, created this massive project, but you're able to hit all these standards and more that more than what you were expected to. And we do that often as educators. We just don't document that as well as we need to. But being able to have some kind of tangible or digital product at the end, that doesn't go away. Like, no one can ever take that away from you as a teacher or the students. It's living. And so that's why I love PBL, because, you know, it's not a piece of paper we throw away at the end of the year when we switch schools or when we switch classrooms. This thing lives. And so, you know, my students were excited. They were empowered. I'm in the middle of editing those now, hopefully to be done early next week. But yeah, it was just a remarkable experience to be able to have all of those learning objectives in one project over, what do we do it over over a quarter. We spent like almost three months on it, but it was really neat.
Well, I would actually love to end there. And actually, I'm going to ask my Leader of Learning listeners to rewind a few minutes and go back, because I want to end on that note, because I'm super passionate about it. And for me, heading into next school year, that is what is driving me first and foremost more than anything. The idea of getting our students to be content creators first and consumers, not even second, like much way further down the road. And to get our teachers to be less of those content providers. And, you know, not to sound too cliche, but the guide on the side, right, to be the facilitator of the student learning rather than just being that expert and forcing ideas and thoughts and knowledge down.
And it's hard.
Students. Oh, yeah.
Dude, when you do it for the first time, it's still hard for me to go, oh, step back. Let them figure it out. Step back.
You know, I say this, I've said this for a long time. Educators are clearly a special breed of human. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they are some of the most passionate people there are. Yeah. They're passionate about their content. They're passionate about working with students. But I think sometimes that passion gets the best of them to the point where it becomes really a control issue. They want, they think they need to control everything and they don't. And so my advice for the listeners here and as we wrap up, to take Leon's idea there about getting students to be content creators versus just content consumers. Listen, clearly, those of you listening probably have much more knowledge about a lot of things than your students do, and that's okay. But let's find what they can do and expose that, and let's find ways to get our students to be more of the experts without necessarily having to exert our expertise in such forceful ways, I guess, is my advice. But Leon, I thank you so much for your time. I'm really glad that we were finally able to connect like this. You know, again, we go back a ways, but I think that a lot of the ideas that you shared here are helping me, and I know that they're going to help my listeners to head into next school year with some really great ideas and a mindset to where we need to take what we've learned over the last couple of years and really use that to our benefit as we head into this next phase, which I think is a really exciting phase in education. So thank you for your time and thank you for your thoughts and ideas.
Anytime.
Well, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't done so yet, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app. Also, if you enjoy the content shared on the show, please recommend this podcast to other educators, leaders, friends, or anyone you think would love listening and learning. I would also appreciate it if you would leave a positive rating and review on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, or whatever podcast app you use to listen. For more information about me or this show, head over to leaderoflearning.com. While you're there, you can also find the Leader of Learning blog, how to connect on social media such as Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Voxer, sign up for our newsletter, and even find out how to purchase Leader of Learning merchandise. Thanks again, and remember, no matter who you are or where you are, you too can be a leader of learning.